Let's start with the two theory questions first. So the first question had to do with reduction. You're told that aldehydes and ketones can react with either sodium borohydride or lithium aluminum hydride to be reduced. You're told that aldehydes are generally more reactive than ketones, and regardless of whether it's an aldehyde or a ketone that you're reducing, lithium aluminum hydride tends to be a more reactive reducing agent than sodium borohydride. And so you're asked, why is it that aldehydes are more reactive than ketones? And you're asked, why is it that lithium aluminum hydride is more reactive than sodium borohydride? So I'll answer those in reverse order. For the reducing agents, it has to do with electronegativity. So boron is less electronegative than hydrogen, and aluminum is even less electronegative than that. You didn't have a periodic table available to you, so you didn't have to specifically state that aluminum was below boron on the periodic table, but you did need to know that aluminum is less electronegative than boron, is less electronegative than hydrogen. So the electronegativity difference between hydrogen and boron is not as great as that between hydrogen and aluminum, so that hydrogen-aluminum bond acts more ionically, or you could say that the hydride is more reactive. So it's on the basis of the difference of electronegativity. As far as the first question, first part of it, the why is it that aldehydes are more reactive than ketones, has the one-word answer is hyperconjugation. Now, you are asked to draw some kind of appropriate diagram, which those of you who are returning students, you probably instantly thought of a SMOG, which for the new students, that's structural molecular orbital graph, which means a picture of the different types of orbitals that you could say make up that molecule. So it's not the type of thing where we go and shade in plus and minus the sign of the wave function, although that kind of drawing we're going to do a lot more of in just a few weeks when we come back to conjugated and aromatic systems. But instead, we just show what things are sp2, sp3, pi bonds, sigma bonds, that type of thing. Now, you didn't even have to, because it didn't specify, you didn't even have to draw a full diagram out, but you needed to show one of two possibilities, either that there is hyperconjugation or that there's not. So to show both of those possibilities, I'm going to do a partial SMOG diagram for ethanol. So ethanol has a pi bond in it. Which we represent with a pair of p orbitals. Attached to the carbon, you've got two things, a hydrogen, or you've got a methyl group, which that methyl group is sp3 hybridized. And notice I am purposely leaving out portion of the molecule, specifically the sp2 hybrids that would be on the carbon and oxygen in the carbonyl. But they don't really matter for this diagram, which is why I'm choosing to leave them out. Because here are the two things you could focus in on. If you have an alkyl group attached to that carbonyl, then you have the possibility of hyperconjugation. Which means that electron density comes from the sigma bond, regardless of whether there was a hydrogen attached to that carbon or not. So this happens to be a methyl group that I'm using to show, but even if you had other alkyl groups attached there, there still would be the sigma bond coming from that carbon. So that sigma bond provides electron density into the pi bond, which stabilizes the pi bond. Well, if you make something more stable, you make it less reactive. That's versus what we have on the other side here with just plain hydrogen, because that hydrogen is at a 90-degree angle to what the p orbital is. So there's absolutely no orbital overlap there. And so there's the lack of stabilization, which means that it's more reactive. Now, there is the potential to possibly make a kinetic argument, because if you have two alkyl groups, that would somewhat block the approach to the carbonyl. But do realize that the carbonyl is planar, So maybe that has an effect, but a large proportion of the effect is due to this hyperconjugation. So let me just draw out here that between the pi bond and the hydrogen, there's a 90 degree angle, so there's no overlap. An aldehyde does have at least one of these hydrogens that's at the 90 degree angle, so it has less hyperconjugation automatically than a ketone would. So questions on that first theoretical problem, either of the halves. Then the second theoretical problem was related to mechanism, and it was about the oxidation of two different alcohols. You were told that if you had butane-1-ol, primary alcohol, that you oxidized in PCC, but in anhydrous conditions, that you ended up with an aldehyde. Turns out, though, if you did allow water in the system, that the compound would continue to oxidize and instead form butanoic acid, a carboxylic acid. You're shown that if you did the same type of procedure with butane-2-ol, where you oxidized it with PCC, it turned out that whether you used water or did not, which for those of you who don't have much computer programming experience, that exclamation point means not. So whether you have water or you don't have water, the result is exactly the same. You end up with a ketone, which you won't oxidize past. So you're asked, why is it that there's a difference in behavior between the primary and secondary alcohol when water is present or not? And it said that you did not have to write the full mechanism out, and I hope that you didn't write the full mechanism out, because most of it isn't related to the question. There's one key point which shows why you can have over-oxidation for a primary alcohol, but can't for a secondary. Now, part of it is, yes, you're going to form a hydrate, which, just to emphasize, you weren't asked to draw the mechanism for forming a hydrate. That mechanism will be on an upcoming examination of some sort, either your quiz or your second exam. Boy, I almost said that's on your quiz, didn't I? So, that formation of a hydrate, though, if it happens with the primary alcohol, well, then when you continue on and make the chromate ester, the main intermediate before the actual oxidation occurs, the super important thing is there is a hydrogen. Which means if a base, water or something like that, comes along, pulls that hydrogen off, kicks off the chromium group, you will have oxidation. But if you look at the case of the secondary alcohol, the key part of that mechanism, the removal of that hydrogen, which forms the double bond with the oxygen, that hydrogen doesn't exist here. So no elimination is possible. That and since you can't remove the hydrogen, you would be creating yet another bond to carbon, so you would end up with five bonds to carbon. So this is the main difference right here, that on a primary alcohol, after the first oxidation, there's one more removable hydrogen, while in the secondary, there is none. And so only the first oxidation, the first removal of the hydrogen is possible. Wasn't asked in the question, but if I put a tertiary alcohol up, there are no removable hydrogens to start with, and so you can't do elimination, which means no oxidation at all. Questions on that problem? Then let's flip to doing mechanism. So first mechanism problem. You had a secondary alcohol which reacted with heat and tosic acid. And I could have just said H plus, but I wanted to show tosic acid to make sure that you know that tosic acid is just an acid catalyst. It is that same acid that both last quarter and this quarter I described as a inexpensive, organic, soluble, strong catalyst. Part of the reason it's a good catalyst, though, is that once it dissociates, the tosylate ion that you get is not nucleophilic. So if you had tosylate participating anywhere in the reaction, then you got off track, because the only thing this compound's going to do is act as an acid catalyst. What's going to happen then? Well, the only logical first step of the reaction is for the OH group to get protonated. Which I'm going to give the same warning that I've given a couple times maybe this quarter. But technically, every single protonation or deprotonation step is a reversible process, because acid-base systems are equilibria systems. But if we're making a product that I'm showing forming by forming irreversibly, then even though individual portions of the mechanism may be reversible, I've been ignoring that. Which I keep pointing this out just in case you end up with a different instructor in the future, either for OCHEM or some more advanced chemistry class, in case they say, well, how come you didn't do it this way?
My instructor told me to.
So, anyways, this gets protonated. We make water, which is a leaving group. It leaves. We form a secondary carbocation, which would like to become a tertiary carbocation, and that's not impossible. But another thing that might happen is that the little bit of ring string that's there gets relieved. That forms a carbocation, which is still secondary, so there's kind of a couple of options here. You could show directly the product that would form in this case, or if you wanted to, you could show one last hydride shift. If you didn't show this shift, it's okay. But one way or another, eventually you would show water removing a hydrogen, which means overall this was a dehydration. And part of the reason I'm showing this as irreversible is, yeah, portions of this mechanism are certainly reversible, but it would be unfavorable to move from a tertiary carbocation back to a secondary, and it would be unfavorable for the ring to contract. So maybe on paper this is all reversible, but in practice, no. Yes? Seven-member rings actually do have a energetic penalty to them, and that's because there's enough of a twist that you get not exactly staggered conformations. And so that raises the energy up a little bit. So yes, you can go from a 4 to a 5 and a 5 to a 6, but you won't go from a 6 to a 7. Six-member ring thermodynamically is the most favorable. Five of is also really darn close to perfectly favorable. So five-member rings you can form, but they can't open like this. Any other question about this mechanism? Okay, then the second mechanism was a three-parter. Started out with a chiral alkyl halide that you first reacted with sodium hydroxide, followed by a chiral epoxide, followed by tosyl chloride. So first part of the mechanism is pretty straightforward. This is a primary alkyl halide that we have a small, basic, strong nucleophile. And so this is going to be SN2. Point of that, besides the fact that we make an alcohol, is that you'll have inversion of configuration of that stereocenter. Now I'm gonna have to interrupt the flow of this mechanism a little bit because the next part, oops, which I left something out, there is an H plus there along with that epoxide, which means this is gonna be cationic epoxide ring opening that occurs. Well, there's a protonation step that occurs before the ring itself opens. So I'm going to show that protonation first and then have this alcohol attack the protonated epoxide ring. So I'll do it this way. Now, once we have that protonated ring, this oxonium ion, the cyclooxonium ion, is very much like the cyclobromonium and cyclomercurinium ions I had referenced when we covered this topic. The commonality between all those is the fact that that ring is unstable more towards one direction than the other. The bond towards the tertiary position is longer and weaker than to the primary. So it'll be the tertiary position that gets attacked. But this is a concerted mechanism. So stereochemistry is going to be inverted at the point of attack. Now that part, maybe you got. An unintended consequence of this problem, though, was an issue with writing the product correctly, which I'll grade very leniently if you did not do correctly, but let me point out what the problem is. So we push this ring open. The right-hand carbon no longer is a stereocenter. Well, it wasn't really to begin with either, but I'll just drop the wedge we're using there. We have inversion of stereochemistry at where the attack had occurred. We have a oxonium ion initially. And then we still have that stereocenter. Well, here's the trick. If you weren't careful about how you wrote that substituent, if you were in a hurry and you wrote that ethyl group with the point pointing the other direction, you had to make sure to use a wedge when you're writing that deuterium. Why? Well, the alcohol that we have, R or S? 2, 4, S? Oxygen, more important than carbon, more important than deuterium. It looks like it's R, but there's a hydrogen pointing at us, so whatever we see, we have to reverse. So yes, it really is S. Did I do it correctly down here? Oxygen, carbon, deuterium. Still looking clockwise, but the hydrogen pointing at us, and still reversed, so yes, it's still S. Did I do this one with the wedge correctly? Oxygen, carbon, deuterium, counterclockwise, but the hydrogen's now pointing away from us the way it's supposed to be. So it is also still S. So I didn't mean for this to be a trick question. But in other words, if you did not draw the ethyl group the right way, or didn't pay attention to that stereocenter, how you were drawing it, then you might have accidentally inverted right there. That might end up only being worth half a point or something, but it is a warning for the future that you got to always watch your stereocenters. The main place I'm thinking this will show up is next quarter when we do amino acids, where we're going to have a whole chain of stereocenters that you got to keep track of. So, continuing on with the mechanism, we have deprotonation. We have an alcohol, and now we have tosyl chloride, which there's different ways that you could write that mechanism. The most compact way is to do the sort of simultaneous wraparound mechanism that I'd shown you, where at the same time the alcohol attacks, sulfonyl opens and closes, kicks out a chlorine. Since I wrote the structure out once, I'll abbreviate now. And there is one last deprotonation step. Questions on the second mechanism? Why don't we go to the fill-in-the-blank problems next then? So first one, we have a chiral epoxide again. That reacts with a basic nucleophile. So since that's basic, which that you know that because of the potassium, it's anionic. We're going to have anionic ring opening of an epoxide, which means it attacks at the less substituted position. So there's the ethoxy group attached to the less substituted position, which it's no longer, or never was, a stereocenter. So again, I'm using a plain line. And the tertiary carbon, where the oxygen ends up at, that one never gets attacked, so the stereocenter doesn't invert there. The part of this question that's going to annoy the crap out of some of you is that I didn't show H plus following up this attack, and so you can't write OH there. You have to leave it as the alkoxide. Because if I don't show H plus, it in there, and you can't create a reagent out of nothing. Yes? And if you don't put the K plus, but you do show the O minus, I'll probably accept that. But do realize that it's not possible really to have a compound that's just an anion or just a cation. So you normally should show a counterion, whichever is appropriate. Now I'm going to keep going through these fill in the blanks. So if you got questions, don't be afraid to stop me. The next one. Ah, yes. This is a mesolate, which hopefully you recognized as being structurally identical to a tosylate. Let me back up a minute. I'm circling what was the answer for that problem. We have some unknown compound that reacts with this mesolate, and we end up with this symmetric ether. Now, I'll probably have liberal partial credit on this problem, because this is not exactly the Williamson ether synthesis, which is what some of you might have tried to recognize it as, that you did take something that had a leaving group to form an ether. But the one big difference here is, what kind of mesolate is this? Primary, secondary, or tertiary? Tertiary. Well, the Williamson ether synthesis technically is an SN2 reaction, where you take a strong nucleophile and you displace a leaving group. But if you have a tertiary substrate and you try to use a strong nucleophile on it, what's going to happen? You're going to have elimination instead. So you do need something to attack in, but it must be non-basic. So it's 1-methyl cyclopentanol. It'll do an SN1 reaction. Yes. No, that's for the synthesis problems. For the fill in the blank problems, it could be any. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, for any of the fill in the blank problems, it's anything that you need to make that happen. For the synthesis problems, those, when we get there, only the starting materials there can be your sources of carbon. Yeah. This other section had a primary group, so they did have an SN2. So they had one more carbon in between here and the oxygen, so theirs really was a Williamson ether synthesis. So their answer had an alkoxide instead of an alcohol. Next one. We have a chiral alcohol reacting with thionyl chloride. This hopefully was an easier problem, because it's exactly the reagents we use to make an alkyl chloride. The one gotcha is that it is inversion of configuration. So you needed to make sure that you inverted that stereocenter. Next one. Small variation of what we did in class, but still hopefully a relatively simple problem. You react an alcohol with something in order to make the potassium alkoxide. Well, if sodium hydride and sodium work to make a sodium alkoxide, and since potassium and sodium are in the same column of the periodic table, hopefully it made sense that the answer here would be either potassium or potassium hydride. If by habit you put sodium down, you'll get partial credit because you had the right idea. It's just it is potassium instead of sodium, which in some applications would matter. Next one was what I thought would be the toughest problem. Something reacts with first lithium aluminum deuteride followed by deuterated sulfuric acid in order to make a doubly deuterated alcohol. So the challenge here is to recognize that the deuterium that's added is not at the same position where the alcohol is. Which, if you think about a carbonyl, whenever you reduce a carbonyl, you're attacking the carbon where the carbonyl is going to open up and therefore the alcohol forms. Well, this, the deuterium's next door to that. So what's the only functional group we learned that we could reduce in this way? It's an epoxide, right? Because reductions of epoxides happen at the less substituted position, which would explain how the deuterium ended up at that part of the molecule. It also would explain why you end up with OD, because after the epoxide ring gets open, normally we'd say protonation occurs, but that's D2SO4, and so that's why deuteration occurs. Yes? Just looked up, huh? Shall we move to the next one? This next one's very much like a problem my old O-Chem prof would ask. This reminds me of, I've never seen one, but I've heard of Macaulay's multiple choice exams where it's A or B and B or C or none or all or some of the above or something like that. Something complicated enough that you almost wish you weren't taking a multiple choice exam. So this one had three different alcohols on it. Primary, secondary, tertiary. Said that this reacted with excess chromium trioxide in sulfuric acid and water, the conditions of the Jones reagent, which means over-oxidation is going to occur. So, for the primary alcohol, that means it turns into a carboxylic acid. For the secondary, that means it turns into a ketone. For the tertiary, nothing happens. Oops, that's the answer there. Two more problems. An aldehyde getting reduced to an alcohol. But not just any alcohol, an alcohol with a deuterium on it. So how did this occur? Well, first, it was lithium aluminum hydride or sodium borohydride. Why? Because a hydrogen ends up at the position where the carbonyl was. There's no deuterium in the middle of the molecule there. So that means hydride was used originally. But then when working up the reaction, in order to get the alcohol with the deuterium on it, it needed to react with D plus afterwards. Which if you, I think there was a synthesis, around the synthesis problems we did one day where I showed you the two possibilities. Reducing with deuterium and then protonating, or reducing with hydride and then deuterating. Puts the deuterium in alternate positions. Then the last, oh yes. Sure. Why the what? I'm sorry.
Why the ketone does not get protonated because we have an acid?
It is. The question was, why isn't it the ketone not going to get protonated? Will get protonated, and in fact, in solution, it'll form a hydrate. So technically, if you answered with the ketones being hydrates instead, it's sort of correct. It's just that if you went to isolate the compound, hydrates are not normally thermodynamically stable; they revert back to the ketone, since it is a reversible process, though, and you could assume it's in solution. If you showed a hydrate, it'd be okay. If you showed a protonated carbonyl, yeah, technically it would be there, but it wouldn't be an isolatable compound. Yes? Can you put MABD4? No, because then that would put the deuterium right there, which means you'd end up with the deuterium right there. That's what sections 1 and 2 had on their exam. They had the deuterium here and a hydrogen there, so it was backwards. Which, if you came a day early, so your exam was their exam. So yours, it would have been backwards, so it would have been correct for you. Yes. Oxidized, that was the point of showing water there. So then if you did oxidize the other parts or did the rest of it correctly, you'll get partial credit for that, but you'll lose a point or two because of the carboxylic acid. Let's do the last fill in the blank problem then. Which was a two-stepper, something reacting first with PBr3, followed by sodium iodide in acetone to form an alkyl iodide. So hopefully you've recognized that as the process of the Finkelstein reaction, where you start with an alkyl halide and then you do the solubility trick to convert it into an iodide. That second step, because this is a secondary position, is an SN2 reaction, which means it's inversion, and PBr3 reacts by inversion as well. So two inversions mean nothing happens overall in terms of stereochemistry. And so the reactant is this alcohol. It must be an alcohol because that's what PBr3 reacts with. Any last questions on the synthesis problems? Then let's do the synthesis problems because I'm sure you're curious about those. The first one was inspired by couple of problems we did in practice, because it involved the alkylation of an alkyne. We examined the reactants and products. You notice that we maintained the total number of carbons, which is good because we hadn't yet learned how to mess with the number of carbons, really. But notice that where the aldehyde is, there's a new bond between that position and the alkyne, which that should have clued you into the fact that this is an alkylation reaction. In order to do alkylation, we need to have an alkyne salt, one of those acetylide ions, which we could easily get from one of the starting materials. So one of the starting materials we do very little with. The other one, though, we need to convert into a leaving group, because you need a leaving group to do alkylation. Well, we don't know how to directly make a leaving group from an aldehyde, and so I was hoping that you'd also think about the way that I played up alcohols when we did synthesis problems, that alcohols are often a synthetic intermediate. Do we know of a way, in fact, of going from an alcohol to a leaving group? Yeah, several ways. Do we know how to go from an aldehyde to an alcohol? Yes, and so that's the sequence of steps you want to have taken. Take the aldehyde, reduce it, which in real life it's much easier to do a sodium borohydride reduction. Once you get the alcohol, turn it into a leaving group, which, why not make a tosylate? Really good leaving group. Notice that I did try to be careful with the way that I chose the substrate, because next door to the leaving group is a quaternary carbon, meaning there's no hydrogens on it, meaning no E2 or E1 is possible in this system. So you're only going to get substitution. To do that substitution, we need the acetylide ion, which the reagent we saw last quarter was sodium amide. Now, I never did get around before the exam to firmly establishing whether hydride H- had enough basicity to do this deprotonation. Since I didn't check, though, I'm going to go ahead and accept sodium hydride as an answer or as a reagent here. Now, one reagent that I really would have to check on is sodium borohydride or lithium aluminum hydride, because even though they are sources of hydride, they're very different types of reagents because of the boron and the aluminum. I keep saying we need to come back to it. In fact, I was reading up on it yesterday. We just won't have time to do it in lecture today. We do need to talk about a slightly different way of seeing those mechanisms that would help explain why they react differently than sodium hydride. So, sodium amide, I'll accept. Sodium hydride, I'll accept at this point. And like I said, I'll have to go back and check in a hurry, though, whether lithium aluminum hydride or sodium borohydride would be acceptable. Once you get to the acetylide, though, you simply combine those two together. An SN2 occurs, and you end up with the product. Questions on that first synthesis? Then the second synthesis, involved making exactly the type of deuterated compound I was mentioning a moment ago when we were talking about reductions of carbonyl compounds. So notice, first of all, that we end up with an alcohol at the same position as the bromide, which means it's unlikely that it involves an alkene, an alkyne, or an epoxide, because those are functional groups that normally I've been exploiting to move the position of a functional group. And you might think this could just be a plain old SN2 reaction, except for the fact that you do have the deuterium there. And so the point of this was, could you remember another way of introducing deuterium into the system, which is to reduce an aldehyde using lithium aluminum deuteride? So if we want to reduce an aldehyde, we have to make one first. We can't make one directly from the bromide, but we can make one, again, from an alcohol intermediate. So we could use sodium hydroxide, which in real life, yes, there's the possibility we'd have a little bit of byproduct, that maybe a little elimination could occur. But there's enough distance from this alkyl group and the place where substitution's occurring, that shouldn't be much of a real problem. And sodium hydroxide is a small base. So out of all the possible bases to use, this might have the least chance of elimination. From here, we do PCC in pyridine. It would be understood that those are anhydrous conditions. That would get us to the aldehyde. And then it's the backwards of the fill-in-the-blank problem. Sodium borodeuteride to reduce, followed by H+ to get the product. Questions on that synthesis problem? All right, then what we need to accomplish in lab today is the following. If you are one of those very few people that didn't finish lab one, got to get that done so you can get the lab report in. Hopefully, you will also get through your IR for experiment two today. You are supposed to be continuing to work with experiment three, which, let me make a comment about some solution behavior that was confusing the heck out of the first two sections. But I also want to challenge you to use your intuitive skills before you just give up and say, wait, what do I do next? Because the situation they were all facing is this solid that many of you probably are going to end up with when you open up your drawers. The solid is very likely the byproduct from this reaction, which you would be able to tell if you were to add the organic solvent, methylene chloride, to your reaction mixture. Now think, in fact, what is the first sequence of steps after the reaction? Well, it's a series of washes. will realize that the reason you're using both an aqueous and an organic solvent is you're going to have byproducts that may be organic soluble, and you're going to have the product, which is organic soluble. So when you start to work with reaction mixtures, if you have a solid, well, what do you do to get rid of a solvent? Dissolve it, right? Well, how do you dissolve it? Add a solvent. Well, what happens if one solvent doesn't dissolve it? Add the other one. This is the same kind of logic we're going to use when working up solutions in the future. There are going to be reactions, potentially, where you'll end up with solids that don't dissolve in either layer. But this is not one of those labs. So just by adding enough of one solvent or the other, you should be able to get everything into a form of a solution. Now, what if you don't form two layers? Now, there's several places in the lab where you're supposed to be separating layers out. Well, what would you do if you don't have two layers? Add more of each of the solvents until you do. So I know that some of this might not be immediately intuitive, because this is a new technique for you. But section one, I think they were just tired, and so when they faced something, they didn't know what to do without thinking they were asking me. It's not that I'm telling you don't ask me questions, but think through what is it you're trying to accomplish first. See if you can reason it out. And then if you're really totally stuck, then ask me. And I saw a hand go up somewhere. Okay, so now the lab for pre-lab. I know I made the statement that if you don't get any guidance from me, that everything was still going to be the due date that I had originally, but I'm not checking pre-labs. But if you did look at experiment four, you know that there's glassware that we need to put in the oven to be ready for the next lab. If you didn't do the pre-lab for experiment four, well, then I'm just telling you, there is glassware that you need to have washed and put into the oven today so that you can walk in and be ready to use it during your Grignard reaction that we're going to start on Thursday. You absolutely have to have the whole pre-lab done for Thursday, because you can't stop a Grignard reaction. Once you start the Grignard reaction, not only do you have to complete the synthesis of the Grignard reagent, but you then have to react it with the next compound as well, or else the Grignard reagent will just decompose over time. And we're going to talk in lecture why it would decompose, the common things that cause it. Yes? No, and I'm glad you asked that, because we don't have enough separatory funnels for everybody to have their own, and we're not going to be doing the addition through a separatory funnel. Yeah, no, we're going to use the syringe for once. Now, I didn't catch it in time. And my one comment will be, common sense is not so common. Because I understand some people put their stir bars in the oven. But if you think about it, it's just plastic. So I don't know what the condition of their stir bars are going to be when they go to their glassware tomorrow. But I'm just going to tell you all, don't put pieces of plastic in the oven. That oven's for glassware. Now, some people were shocked when they said, wait, why are they putting the magnesium in? Well, because if you did read the whole pre-lab, it wants you to put the magnesium in to start with. So yes, put the magnesium in there. That does mean, again, for those of you who didn't do your pre-lab for number four yet, don't sit and do the whole thing right now. But read through enough of it so you know which items that you need to put in the oven and what to do with the magnesium. Now, this oven is already filled up. Be very careful when you put the glassware in the oven. We did have one person whose glassware was a little bit precipitately placed, and just by opening the oven, it crashed. So we'll need to use the oven in there, which there should be enough room. Just leave a little corner of room to put the IR materials, which, by the way, again, common sense, not so common. Someone the other day put, and it could have even been the 1012A sections that did this, but someone put the bottle of potassium bromide with the plastic lid in the oven, which means the plastic lid melted to the glass so that we had to throw that container away. So I've got another container of potassium bromide in there. But just, again, think through what you're doing. Now, so we have the glassware preparation, finishing up lab 3, getting the IRs for lab 1 and 2.